Deutsche Welle Spotlight on Europe.
Hello and a warm welcome to yet another edition of Spotlight on Europe. My name is Eunice Wanjiro, coming to you from our studios in Bonn, Germany. Coming up in the next half hour, Brexit talks have finally begun. But for Britain, they did not start off with a bang. And the Sierra Leonean community in the UK gathers to mourn the loss of one of their members in the Grenfell Tower fire. And the Museum of Failure in Sweden opens its doors. You'll get to hear of some of the failures displayed.
So McDonald's says, hey, let's develop a burger for adults. And they invested $300 million. It failed because who's going to pay for a luxury burger from that establishment?
Stay tuned for these stories and more here on Spotlight on Europe. Russia has cancelled a high-level meeting with senior US officials. The talks were aimed at mending fences during a time of diplomatic tension. But a new set of US sanctions against Russian individuals and organizations prompted Russia's foreign ministry to put the meeting on ice. Kathleen Schuster has the details in this roundup of European news.
The U.S. issued sanctions against 40 Russians and Russian groups this week in a bid to pressure Moscow into halting military activity in eastern Ukraine. In response, the Russian Foreign Ministry canceled a meeting with U.S. Undersecretary of State Tom Shannon, which was scheduled for Friday. The sanctions date back to 2014, when the U.S. and EU accused Russia of annexing Crimea and of providing military supplies to pro-Moscow separatists in eastern Ukraine, accusations long denied by the Kremlin. Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybkov has called the attempt to put Russia under pressure futile. And while the U.S. said it remained open to mending fences, there was no indication from Russia the meeting would be rescheduled. U.S.-Russian diplomatic relations have reached an all-time low this year, also with tensions over Russian involvement in the Syrian war. Washington has also accused Russia of attempting to intimidate its diplomats. Meanwhile, critics of the Trump administration suspect his team of colluding with Russian President Vladimir Putin to swing the 2016 presidential election in his favor. Germany's parliament has formally approved the withdrawal of German troops from the Turkish base of Incirlik. The 260 German soldiers stationed at the base on the Turkish-Syrian border are part of the fight against the so-called Islamic State. According to the German Defense Ministry, they will be restationed at a base in Jordan, which is also used by other NATO partners. The decision comes amid heightened diplomatic tensions between the two NATO partners. German politicians have openly criticized President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's government for mass crackdowns against dissent since last July's failed coup attempt. Erdogan's government, in response, barred German politicians from routine visits to the Incirlik airbase. Following the parliamentary vote, the Bundestag expressed its regret over the strained relations. The decision to remove German forces from a NATO member country is unprecedented. Analysts say the withdrawal might cause a short-term setback in the fight against Islamic State. France's new government witnessed a shakeup this week. Following allegations of misusing EU funds, four cabinet ministers resigned from President Emmanuel Macron's team, beginning with Defense Minister Sylvie Goulard. The newly elected leader was already expected to reshuffle his cabinet, but the departure of key political allies came just 5 weeks in office. Macron has tapped relative unknowns for key positions. Among them is railway executive Florence Parly, who was named defense minister. Macron won the presidential elections in a landslide victory in May, beating out right-wing leader Marine Le Pen. That was followed by a resounding victory for his centrist party and its allies in parliamentary elections, which all but decimated the incumbent Socialist Party. Macron is now expected to use presidential decrees to push through reforms that will ease tough labor laws and overhaul France's social security system. Critics of the reforms have warned they will prompt nationwide union strikes and mass protests. Romania's parliament has ousted its prime minister, Soren Grindeanu, in a no-confidence vote. Grindeanu had pledged ambitious policy and economic reforms when he took office at the beginning of the year. But a recent performance assessment by his Social Democratic Party showed disappointing results. The Prime Minister blasted the performance review and accused the Social Democratic Party leader of trying to consolidate power. The outgoing Prime Minister was already mired in controversy shortly after taking office this year. After attempting to pass a bill to decriminalize several corruption offenses, Romanians took to the streets. The mass protests were the largest the country had seen since the fall of communism in 1989. The High Court in London has declared tennis champion Boris Becker bankrupt. The German-born tennis legend had reportedly failed to pay a long-standing debt. Private bankers filed the claim against him over a quote-unquote substantial sum owed. That number has not been released to the public. In the court's findings, Becker had not provided sufficient evidence he could repay the debt soon, despite his defense that he could remortgage a house on the island of Mallorca. The tennis star wrote on Twitter that he would challenge the bankruptcy ruling. Becker became an international sensation in 1985 when he won Wimbledon at the age of 17, the youngest male tennis player ever to do so. He went on to win six major Grand Slams.
Kathleen Schuster with that roundup of European news. Much-anticipated Brexit talks, where Britain negotiates the terms of its formal exit from the European Union, have finally begun on schedule. The talks are expected to last at least 15 months and are likely to go on for longer. From Britain's point of view, though, it was not the best time to start the talks. The British Parliament has reconvened after the recent general elections, with the government of Prime Minister Theresa May severely weakened. From London, Stephen Beard reports.
Apart from the trumpets, it was a low-key, stripped-down state opening of Parliament. The Queen arrived by car rather than the golden carriage, and she didn't wear her crown. Her speech, spelling out the government's programme, was dominated by one subject, Brexit.
My ministers are committed to working with Parliament, the devolved administrations, business and others to build the widest possible consensus on the country's future outside the European Union.
She announced eight bills designed to smooth Britain's exit from the European Union in 2019. Many of the Conservatives' general election pledges were not included, as the government has lost its overall majority, making it more difficult to get its programme through Parliament. Opposition lawmaker Kirsty Blackman said it did not augur well for Prime Minister May.
She hasn't been able to put forward her headline pledges from her manifesto. If Theresa May can't put forward a Queen's speech based on her manifesto, how is she going to negotiate Brexit?
The Brexit talks between Britain and its European partners to hammer out the terms of the UK's departure from the EU started 2 days before the Queen's speech. Conservative member of the House of Lords, Michael Heseltine, said the talks had been totally overshadowed by uncertainty about May's future.
I think that it's not conceivable that she will lead the Conservatives into another election. So I think that the realistic appraisal she has to make is how does she secure the best possible successor for the Conservative Party.
Heseltine, an ardent supporter of Britain's EU membership, said May's plan for a hard Brexit, a clean break with the European Union, was now in ruins.
I think that the idea of a hard Brexit is not credible. I don't think there's the majority for it in Parliament. We have a split cabinet. We have a split country.
And he repeated, a prime minister whose authority has been fatally damaged. May has certainly had a torrid time of late. In her clumsy election campaign, she frittered away a 20-point lead in the opinion polls. There have been three terrorist attacks. And within days of her dire election result, a terrible fire in a London tower block, killing at least 79 people. This was the furious response of the crowd when May belatedly met with survivors of the disaster. May was accused of cold indifference, her government blamed for the spending cuts that left the tower block vulnerable to fire. But while rumours of a plot to topple May swirled around Westminster, many of her lawmakers, like Sarah Wollaston, rallied to her defence.
this isn't the time to be falling apart. I think it's the time to get behind Theresa May now and support her in the job she's got to do. The question is, you know, is her position vulnerable right now? No, I don't think so, because we've got a really important negotiation ahead of us.
But May called the election to gain a bigger majority to strengthen her hand in those Brexit talks, and yet she lost her majority. Hasn't she been severely weakened? Conservative commentator Toby Young.
I don't think her position in the Brexit negotiations has been seriously undermined.
Yes, he concedes May has certainly suffered an electoral setback, but she did emerge with the largest share of the vote. And he claims her approach to Brexit, severing the UK's most basic ties with the EU so it can have its own control over immigration and strike its own trade deals, that approach is intact.
The party that Theresa May led in the last general election won 42.5% of the popular vote. And the opposition party, Labour, is also in favour of pretty much the same Brexit strategy as the Prime Minister. So I don't think what happened in the election should undermine her negotiating position.
But eager to exploit the government's weakness, Labour has, since the election, shifted its position. Some of its spokespeople are now calling for a softer Brexit, retaining key links with the EU. Without an overall majority, with 8 Brexit bills to pass, the government's embarked on these critical negotiations with an EU that is for once united. In the current febrile mood here, many fear that national humiliation could be looming. Stephen Beard, DW, London.
Now, still in Britain, the fire which devastated the 24-storey Grenfell Tower in West London last week was really fierce, such that the capital's police force have said that they may never be able to identify all of the victims. The cladding used on the residential block has widely been blamed for the rapid spread of the fire. The government says another 600 tower blocks in England are clad with the same panels. Some communities and family members are still waiting for news of their missing loved ones. One of those groups is the UK's Sierra Leonean community, which travelled to the tower block from around the UK to pay tribute to Zainab Dean, who lived on the 14th floor with her son Jeremiah. They're both believed to have perished after Zainab was told to stay in her flat. Philip Warwick has this report.
Tearful members of the UK's Sierra Leonean community travelled from as far as Manchester and Birmingham to pay tribute to the missing mother and her 2-year-old son. Friends carried flowers, photos and wore T-shirts featuring Zainab's picture. The group sang Christian hymns as they walked in the shadow of the charred tombstone in the West London sky. Among them was Alimatu Dimonekene, a prominent women's rights campaigner.
This has left the whole community, the whole country, shocked. I'm a much older person and I've never, ever experienced this in my lifetime. And it really hurts to see this many people who've lost their lives. And it's going to be hard for the families.
Overcome with emotion, the group spontaneously sang the Sierra Leonean national anthem. Members of the community included second and third generation British Sierra Leoneans, but also those born in the West African state. Some had lived through the decade-long brutal civil war that devastated the country in the 1990s. Many had fled to safety here in the UK. Sierra Leone's motto, Unity, Freedom, Justice, seemed apt as one of the event's coordinators, Mariatu Siddiqui, reflected on past and present experiences.
Because we all know from Sierra Leone, we know what we face. People here, I'm sure you faced the war.
Yes.
You faced major things in Sierra Leone. When I saw this incident, I wake up in the morning, getting ready to work. I sat on my sofa, shaking. I had to call my workplace and say, I'm not going to come. I'm going to be a little bit late. Only because I just thought about it. This is not a war, but to me, it just seems like a war. But let's just pray that God gives the government, the council, the sense and the knowledge to understand and see people's needs.
In Grenfell's communal hallways, official signs had advised residents to stay put in their flats in case of a fire. Residents who ignored those instructions escaped with their lives. Francis Dean, Zainab's brother, telephoned his sister at around 2 a.m. He said she was crying and told her to get out via the tower's staircase. By that time, thick smoke was overwhelming each consecutive floor. In the midst of the chaos and confusion, the emergency services had told her to stay inside her flat. Francis was the last person to talk with Zainab. He lost contact with her at around 4 in the morning. He's still visibly shaken by the tragedy.
I think God is just giving me the strength to try to go through this situation. And I think Zainab is like, our soul is probably inside me trying to say, tell these people what happened. I don't know, it's quite hard for me right now, to be honest. I don't know if I could be able to talk to you.
...60% of Sierra Leone's population is Muslim. Christians make up a third of the population. In the shadow of the burnt tower, members of the community said both a Muslim and Christian prayer. It was a mark of respect to Zainab, her son, and all of the other victims of the fire. Faith Minister Pamela Williams led the Christian prayer.
I pray, Father God, for the family, that you will touch the hearts of the family and heal them and comfort them. And also the Sierra Leone community who are asking questions why. Father God, speak to their hearts in the mighty name of Jesus Christ.
Darren Cummings was born in Sierra Leone and came to the UK with his family when he was 8 years old. Prior to travelling to West London, he'd seen the scorched tower a few times on television. But coming face to face with it sent chills down his spine.
When I came for this event and walked past and turned around to my right and saw that building, I tell you what, it's unexplainable the feeling that I had within myself, because it kind of froze me for a few seconds. It just humbled me to see the actual building itself standing there, just thinking about those people who have perished, those who were missing, those who saw their death. Because it's one thing to die, it's another thing when you know you're going to die. The terrifying moments, their last moments, those who were on the phone speaking to loved ones before they passed away, the traumas of those who were listening to their loved ones trapped in that building who could not do anything to help them. I mean, it's just too much to take in at this moment in time. And, man, what can you say?
Images of the missing are to be seen everywhere on the streets and estates around Grenfell Tower. They're posted on buildings, walls, lampposts and telephone boxes. But the names of the missing are now joining the roll call of the dead, and it will be many days before the emergency services have finished searching for the fire's victims. Philip Warwick, DW, London.
You're listening to Spotlight on Europe with me, Eunice Wanjiro.
I'm all right, I'm okay. Another day and another hour. Going wings to fly like eagles. Reaching for the stars and further.
The history of the Baltic states is one of invasion, occupation and annexation by foreign forces, and then hard-fought regained independence just 26 years ago. But as Terry Schultz found when she visited Lithuania, these governments and their citizens are now laying out the welcome mat for their NATO allies.
Mardis Stelmokas watched all the armored vehicles and weaponry arrive in his neighborhood, accompanied by hundreds of troops. Lithuanians have observed this kind of scene play out before with excruciating consequences. During World War II, 4 years of brutal German occupation gave way to more than 50 years of forced Soviet annexation. But Stelmokas and his family weren't sheltering inside, hiding the valuables from inevitable demands of the camouflage-faced soldiers swarming the fields. They were out taking selfies with the troops.
It's very exciting. It's the first time we see in these big tanks here.
He's too young to remember, quipped an older relative, alluding to visits by big tanks in decades gone by that weren't quite so exciting. Stamoulis goes on happily describing how French soldiers let his little boy sit in a tank and start it, calling the presence of foreign forces in his front yard only positive. The presence of thousands of troops in the Baltic countries is part of NATO's Sabre Strike, annual exercises that this year are incorporating the alliance's four new battle groups stationed in Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland, led by the UK, Canada, Germany, and the US, respectively. The long-term deployment of roughly 1,000 armed personnel in each country, making up a new NATO effort called the Enhanced Forward Presence, or EFP, was approved at last year's Warsaw Summit and assembled in just a few months. The exercises, held May 28th through June 24th across the Baltic states and Poland, are designed to fine-tune international compatibility and also to formally inaugurate the battle groups, which reached full operational capacity this week. If this experience is a world of difference for Lithuania and the other Baltic states, that's also the case for Germany, often seen as reluctant to take a leading role in NATO and constantly mindful of the need for Bundestag approval for offensive action. Germany stepped up as the lead nation for Lithuania's battle group at the express request of President Dalia Grybauskaitė.
It was a very simple and easy choice for us because we are very friendful with Germany, with Chancellor. We know her responsible attitude towards the threats. She understands what these threats meant for East Germany also.
Lithuanian Defense Minister Raimundas Karoblis said, while Lithuania's wartime experience with Germany is a very painful memory, it's one that's long gone. He would like to see more German influence in all practical areas, including security and defense.
Yes, American presence and leadership in NATO and worldwide is good, but also I think that it is the time for Germany to take the leadership, and this is the EFP presence here and leadership in Germany, we expect that it's also one of the beginning stages of such leadership in Europe.
As far as the Baltics are concerned, there's no time like the present for that. In September, Russia and Belarus will be holding their military exercises, called Zapad, just over the border from here, practicing for a potential ground war with NATO. As he marked the inauguration of the battle groups in Latvia Monday, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg promised the alliance would be keeping a close eye on the Kremlin.
We don't see any imminent threat against any NATO allied country. But what we have seen is a more assertive Russia. We have seen a significant military buildup also in the Baltic region. And we have seen Russia being willing to use military force against neighbors, as we have seen in Georgia and in Ukraine. And that's the reason why NATO is responding with the biggest reinforcement of our collective defense since the end of the Cold War.
Marta Stemokas says while he feels confident that NATO will protect Lithuania, he can't help feeling just a bit nervous.
You can tell the future, looking in the history.
He says he's happy to share his front yard with NATO troops as long as they like. Terry Schultz, DW, Jonava District, Lithuania.
Moving west across the Baltic, the Wild has a new museum that will be an interesting place to visit for budding entrepreneurs, and for that matter, those who don't have the nerve to become budding entrepreneurs. Sweden's Museum of Failure in the south coast city of Helsingborg opened its doors on June the 7th. Our reporter John Lawrenson went to take a look.
In the Failure Museum with its creator, the psychologist Samuel West.
This is the Roland 303 synthesizer.
Okay, this is a bass synthesis. It's supposed to replace the bass player, yeah?
Yes. The problem with it is that it sounds nothing like a bass guitar.
Okay, that is a problem.
That's a problem. and it wasn't popular. They couldn't basically not give them away. It was a weird sort of sound to it. And the manual weighed more than the actual device.
Uh-huh.
And then it was so difficult to program, so people just gave up. There's rumors that Roland, the manufacturer, dumped a whole bunch of these in the Tokyo Bay.
Then DJs in Chicago got hold of this synth after the thing had gone out of production and invented acid house music. There's usually a moral to the 70 tales of failure in this museum. For the Roland 303, it might be what your product's good for might not be what you think it's good for. Take Kodak. Made a lot of money printing photos, 160,000 employees, invented the digital camera you can see in the museum, invented an online photo sharing site before Facebook and Instagram, but thought all that was good for was keeping their photo printing business going. Failed to change their business model, went bankrupt. But if failure doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. If you can learn from it, if you can keep going. Like Winston Churchill said, success is going from failure to failure without losing enthusiasm.
This is a good one. Tell us about this one.
Okay, you might wonder why there's a McDonald's hamburger carton behind glass in a museum. This is the McDonald's Arch Deluxe from 96. McDonald's had a reputation of being a children's restaurant. So that McDonald's says, hey, let's develop a burger for adults. And they invested $300 million. In 96, that's a lot of money. It failed because who's going to pay for a luxury burger from that establishment? And number two, they failed because their ad campaign showed children eating the adult burger and frowning with disgust.
The moral, don't forget who you are. Like for a couple of other turkeys in this museum, Harley Davidson perfume and Colgate ready-made dinners.
Nu gör han ett uppsnack innan mötet.
Helsingborg City Council's head of future, Mikko Grönholm, addressing a conference on innovation. Helsingborg is Sweden's fastest growing city and a bit of a tech hub. The Failure Museum's organisers told me that while companies are busy organising private, even secret museum visits, all have refused to donate failed products. They don't want their names associated with the F word in any way. The City Council, on the other hand, is providing some of the museum's finance to make sure the museum opens here rather than elsewhere. So I ask Mikko Grönholm, isn't he worried about making the city a sort of European failure capital?
I would love that, make Helsingborg a capital of failure. Because everybody that works with innovation, that works with new stuff, startups for instance, know that failure is important for innovation. If you want to innovate, if you want to develop something, if you do want something new, you have to accept that failure is not an option. You have to fail. Every innovation everywhere is a result of a number of small failures. And we are focusing on innovation in Helsingborg. We want to rethink how municipalities and cities act and work. So we need to innovate. And in order to innovate, we also have to fail, to accept to fail. And we have to learn to fail in the right way.
So this is Trump the Game.
Yeah, it's called I'm Back, You're Fired. It's a simplified and boring version of Monopoly. And the whole thing is to buy and sell Trump real estate and make a killing off of it.
Okay.
The dice, check them out. They have a...
You got a T there.
Yeah.
Is that instead of the six?
Yeah.
You got Mr. Trump's face on the money.
Everywhere. If you look at Trump, I could have an entire museum with just Trump products. Trump vodka, Trump steaks, Trump university, Trump this, Trump that. The guy is a walking pile of failure. And he's now the president of the United States.
Mm.
I see the brand Trump and him as a person as a living proof that you don't have to be so afraid of failure.
John Lauritsen, DW, Helsingborg, Sweden.
That brings us to the end of this edition of Spotlight on Europe. Thank you for tuning in. We hope you've enjoyed the show and would love to hear from you. Visit our Facebook, just look for DW Africa, and make sure to leave your comments there. We'll be back next week with another edition of Spotlight on Europe. On behalf of the entire team, I'm Eunice Njiro. Bye and take care. Já não quer mais conversar ao vivo com ninguém. Mergulha de cabeça pela tela e some. Me diz para que tanto selfie, eu hein? Pode o mundo em volta estar caindo, que ela nunca vai se abalar. Você fala, ela finge estar ouvindo, mas na verdade não tá.